Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming, or thank you for winning your lottery positions or engaging in our eBay market for tickets for this event. I was happy to see that there was active trading this morning in, I believe they were called eBriar tickets, and there you could exchange some of them. So first, let me thank Justice Breyer not only for being here and treating us to a lecture yesterday, but for staying today in order to talk about something else. Title of the operation of the court, but the general pattern for today is that the justice will make a few comments, opening remarks, but he understands that we are aggressive questioners, aggressive but respectful questioners. And so I encourage you with short questions, but let's engage him with questions as soon as he permits. And then, as you know, we will finish no later than 1:15 because we have you and I both. Have classes after this. So one should never compare justices when introducing a justice, but let's just say that I give you our favorite justice.
I thought maybe I would... Since you had to sit through this, there was a terribly long lecture yesterday. I realized my wife the other night said, well, I think you should speak more briefly. And I said, well, that's not very nice. She said, afterwards, at dinner, I was trying to speak briefly. I said, that was the best dinner we ever had. All right, so Nako could be very, very succinct. I'll try to be succinct. What do I do every day at the court? I get up, go to the court. And my job is reading and writing. You probably know that. And when I talk to high school students, I say, if you do your homework very well, you will get a job where you can do homework the whole rest of your life. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. I mean, it's a very academic job. It is an ivory tower. When I try to describe it to the high school students, I really want to make 3 points to them. The first thing is about law, and I said, well, where do you think, in what city? I was at my old high school in San Francisco day before yesterday, and I was talking to them, and they didn't do as well as many high school students on this question. I said, what city, what is the city where most of the law that affects you is made? In terms of law that affects you, your parents, everybody else, what's the right city? And what do you think they said? What do you think they should have said? Right, correct. You see, you've got no problem here. A lot of them did say Sacramento. But then why I do that is I try to point out, as you know, that most law, family law, most criminal law, commercial law, almost all of it, tort law, you name it, education law, environmental law, really. Almost all of it is states. You say, how much? I say 95%. Who knows? But it's about, that's fair enough. So I say, look, you read in the paper, Washington, Washington, but if you want to do something that affects you, if you want to do something that affects your family or your neighbors and your friends, go to Sacramento or stay in San Francisco. Don't run off to Washington just because they get the headlines. That's the point I'm trying to make. And of course, we are a federal court, and federal courts decide state questions, but not us. All the other ones do. And if you look at the 50 state systems and the federal system, you say, what's the ratio of state to federal cases? Now, that doesn't quite do it, because as you know, the states can decide federal questions, and the federal courts can decide state questions, which is done to provide a living to jurisdiction professors so that it won't be too simple. But the point, of course, still, though, is I asked Justice Liakis on the SJC, how many cases are there in the United States every year? He said 32 million. I said, really? He said, but 20 million are traffic tickets. So I said, well, how many altogether? He said, 8 million, probably 9, 10. I said, how do you know? He said, I made it up. But the idea is about that. That's a rough idea. And of those, say, 250,000 are in federal court. So another way to get to the same result. Now, as I said, all the federal courts will consider state questions. We won't. You know, you say another thing I tell high school students to entertain them. You have to keep them entertained and learn something there. But I said, You have trials of these millions of cases. Most settle, thank goodness. The lawyers try to settle them, we hope. Sometimes settle if you go to trial. You have the trial, either state or federal. One side wins, the other side loses. The lawyer thinks the judge, if he's a losing lawyer, he thinks the judge is really an idiot at best. And the winning lawyer thinks, well, he thinks he's a good lawyer. So that is basically gets their attention. And then you focus on the appeal that the loser took, and you go through two or three levels at the state, one or two anyway, or you might go through a level at the federal court. And then I say there are usually, I do this to round off, it's a rough guess, 80,000, 100,000 cases in either the state Supreme Court's highest state court, or federal appeals courts that have federal issues in them. So that's our base. Now, we get about 8,000 requests every year. Not quite, but almost. So 10% come to us, and we hear about 80. It's an invisible tip. That's why the law is really made in the Court of Appeals. The law is really made in the Courts of Appeals, state Supreme Courts for the state. But we just take this invisible tip. Now, what's important that you don't always learn in respect to, now I have two jobs, what to decide and to decide what we decided to decide. So, but what that first job, what to decide, how do I get to 80 from 800 or 8,000? How do I do that, really? Well, we each have four law clerks, and the law clerks each take about five or six cases a week. Five times 30 is about 150, times 50 is about 8,000. I wasn't that strong in mathematics, but that's roughly correct. So each can do five. See, that's shocking. I should do them. I should do all 150. Well, I'd rather have the law clerks writing those memos and really looking at those scrawled pro se petition thoroughly, which you can do with five, than to have me pretend to do it, because I'd be pretending to do it, because there's no way you're going to read through 150 sets of petitions in a week. So the fact is, the law clerks will, in fact, write memos 2 to 10 pages. We're in a pool, eight of us, and we pass around this big stack of memos. So what I really get, though I have the papers right in back of me on the wall, I can look at them if they want. Occasionally I do, not too often. I have a stack like that. I say, hey, that's still pretty impressive. How do you go from a stack like this to a stack like this? And I do it in about an hour or two. Then you say, oh, you're not doing your job. But in an hour, I can. 2 hours, yeah. Why? Why? What's important, and this is the point I'm leading up to, is what's my criteria for decision? How do I go from the stack like this to that? Those are the possibles. These are the 150. And it's only about 10 or 15 possibles, typically, in a week. And I do that because I'm applying a criterion. What's the criterion? Well, in general terms, the criteria that we're asking ourselves, each of us, is there a need in respect to this legal issue to have a uniform rule nationally on this question of federal law? That's the question. Now, why is it sort of easy to answer? Usually, not always, but usually, not too hard to get the possibles anyway. And were you doing it the first week, I bet you'd end up in about the same pile. Because it's not that easy to answer, not that hard usually to answer, because suppose all the lower court judges have decided the same way. Is there a need for us? No. I mean, this is, Jackson said this very well. He said, we're not... Well, he actually said it in quite a confusing way. He said, we're not final because we're infallible. We're infallible because we're final. Now, no one knows what that means, as I said. But it means we don't have the last word because we're so brilliant. We are, of course, brilliant. But only in the sense that somebody has to have the last word. So if all the other judges, perfectly good judges, have all decided the question the same way, why us? Now, sometimes there's an answer. But normally, there isn't. So, they've all decided the same way. I'm already thinking, well, there's no need for us to decide it. Why should we? Unless there's something quite special. But suppose they've all decided differently the same question. Well, then, is there a need for a nationally uniform rule of federal law? Yeah, probably. Because after all, the law is supposed to be uniform throughout the country. And that isn't a theoretical thing, it's a practical thing. You don't want people over here figuring it means this, and some other place it means that. It would be very confusing and difficult to do business or live in different places. It's a practical thing. We're there to straighten it out. So we're not there, as Taft said 100 years ago when he was Chief Justice, we're not there to review errors. You know, they've already had a trial, an appeal, maybe two appeals, and you couldn't do it. In any way, nobody sees it as that is the job. They do see the job as trying to create this uniform rule of federal law. That's now, I always have to qualify that. Don't take it absolutely. There can be special cases and so forth. But now you can see how I get to that 5 or 10 cases. And now, there I, by the way, suppose I really make a mistake, and everybody makes a mistake. Everybody makes a mistake. We really should have granted this case, and we denied it. What will happen? Anybody? Brave, and I think how they used to talk. Say, what? What'll happen? Yeah.
It'll get brought again.
It'll get brought again. Suppose it never gets brought again.
Wasn't that important?
See? You can't go wrong. And we take some reassurance in that. On the other hand, you know, if we grant a case, and we shouldn't have, because maybe there's a jurisdictional problem in it, wow, that's a problem. Because people go to enormous trouble to prepare these cases. Different groups and lawyers all over the place are all getting briefs written and supporting briefs and so forth. And lo and behold, we get it there. Everybody's finally got the issue in a position for us to decide. We dismiss it. That causes trouble. So it's much, really worse to grant a case you shouldn't have done than it is to deny a case that you should have granted, because the latter will come back and the former will just cause trouble. Right now, I talk to my law clerks now about my small pile. They go back and look it over, my personal clerks, and we go through it on Wednesday. On Wednesday, if I want to put any one of us can put any case on for discussion on Friday. And if it's not put on by somebody, denied automatically. Probably there'll be 10 or 15 put on. And on Wednesday, I'm trying to figure out what do I want put on. And Thursday, I'm back with my clerks. I have the whole list of what everybody's put on. And I go through and figure out how to vote. Sometimes I'll go back now and read one of the opinions. But I usually have a fairly good idea from the nature of the issue. And then on Friday at the conference, the last order of business is always the certs. And we go around in order and briefly discuss each cert. Maybe there are 8 or 10 there. And 4 votes is a grant. Don't have 4 votes, deny. And any one of us can hold it over for a week. If I hold it over for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever I want, I will then write a memo to the conference, usually about why I held it over. And it'll be more informed and more in-depth. And sometimes I didn't have 4 votes. I thought it should be granted, or I was curious about something. And I'll write such a memo. And eventually, it either will, that'll help get it granted. That's the sort of process. All right, so the second part, to my former clerk, Rob Hopkins, is that fair?
Perfect.
See, they think they decide everything, but they don't. the point then is, how do we decide the cases we granted? Well, we hear them in 2 week batches, oral argument in 2 week batches. Oral argument, first 2 weeks of October, November, December, January. Last 2 weeks of February, March, April. Very mechanical. And those 2 weeks, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, is oral argument. Thursday's off to think about it. Friday, word conference. All right, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 2 hours, 10 to 12. Each case, 1 hour. Each lawyer, half an hour. Each side. Almost always. I mean, sometimes they split the time. Sometimes the Solicitor General comes in. I think that time is too short, but others think it's okay. But in any case, that's how it works. Now, before the two-week period, like right now, I'm ready to go back next week, and the week after, we'll be back into our February session. Before I've just finished today on the airplane reading the 10, 12, I think, sets of briefs for February. There are 12 sets of briefs. Now, I've read those 12 sets. I've read all of them, very few there are pretty long there, so towards the end of the Amici, you know, I sort of thumbed through it pretty quickly. I've seen those arguments before, and I'm looking to see if there's something I haven't seen here. But I'll look at each brief, and I'll read pretty thoroughly until I get into the case, and I'm at the stage where I can say, added something to this or not. Now, I probably have a pile of 10 to 12 in most cases. They're all color-coded to keep it simple for us. Say, blue is the petitioner, red is the respondent, yellow is the reply, gray is the government. The government's always gray. Light green, a Mikey supporting the petitioner. Dark green, a Mikey supporting the respondent. And then the white was the petition for cert that has the opinion below. My style is I always start with the opinion below. That's important to remember, particularly when you're in a court of appeals. But the question in a court of appeals, and it's somewhat similar, that's the habit I have, but in a court of appeals, and lawyers forget this sometimes, there's only one question you're asking that Court of Appeals judge. You're saying, if you're the petitioner, the judge below made a mistake of law, a mistake of law that matters to the outcome of this case. So, naturally, as a judge, the first thing I want to know, I want to read what he said, that lawyer, that judge below. I read her opinion, his opinion, and I look at what the mistake is. Now, that's my habit. So naturally, I get a case, I see what the issue is in the Supreme Court. First thing I do is read the lower court opinion, and then I'll read the blue or the red and so forth. And so I've read all 12 briefs, or one of them we have about 40 this time, so the top Texas redistricting. I've read through them. My law clerk has read through, what, three sets. I have four clerks, four into 12 is three. I mean, you have to know some math to be on the Supreme Court. So they each read three sets. I've read 12 sets. I just had a conversation this morning. One of my clerks, who's a Chicago graduate, we were talking about a case. And what we were doing, it's the last one I read. She's been trying to get me to read it for a while. I said, look, this is what I'm worried about here. And she said, well, you didn't quite understand that part. But we've got to learn this, this, and this. So you're going to write something. Please write about this, this, and this. And then she'll do that, and she'll put any other things she wants to put in. So before I go into oral argument, I'll read her memo. I will have another discussion with her. And I'll do that with each of the 12. And then I'm ready for the oral argument. The oral argument, that will be a week from, 2 weeks from now. The nine of us are sitting there. The lawyers are in front of us. And it's really for us to ask questions. It's very difficult for a lawyer. You don't know what you'll be asked. You have a rough idea, but not definite. And you start pleasing one judge, and the other judge starts frowning. I mean, it's not easy at all. And they're quite very good at it, the ones who argue. After the oral argument, we think about it on Thursday. Friday, we're in conference. We go around. Second order of business is discuss the cases we've heard argued. Chief, Don Stevens, used to be Sandra. I've never had a conference with the leader yet, and I'll miss him. A lot. But the Sandra O'Connor, Scalia, Tony Kennedy, David Souter, Clarence Thomas, Ruth Ginsburg, and me. I was last. I've always been last. I won't be anymore. My job as junior, open the door if somebody knocks. And sometimes they do. And sometimes occasionally they had coffee. Not only once or twice. But somebody had a coffee for Justice Scalia about 3 months ago. And I brought it over. And he looked and said, well, you've been doing this for a long time. I said, yeah, I've gotten very good at it. He said, no, you haven't. But we go around in that order and we discuss the case. The key to the discussion of the case, succinct, maybe 5 or 10 minutes a person, maybe 5 minutes, maybe three. They're giving, each member of the court is giving his real reason, not making an argument. And that is a bit, we have loads of arguments. The briefs are filled with arguments. It's not a game of who has the better argument. What it is an effort to tell each other what we're really thinking about this case. And now, as the discussion goes around, nobody speaks twice till everybody speaks once. That's a very beneficial rule for the most junior side of that table. But that's how it works. And we're saying our true reason succinctly, and then there's some back and forth, usually not too much. But it goes on as long as it's fruitful. It's fruitful as long as I'm listening to you and trying to respond to what you say, not out-argue you, but rather when I hear something that I think, oh, I see what he's thinking. Yes, well, maybe he'd think
I'll make this point, which might be relevant to what's worrying him. All right? You see, that's fruitful. But the second it becomes an argument, Rehnquist would always cut it off.
That's it. And he'd cut it off pretty quickly. You know, he doesn't have the power to cut it off, but we all know that you have to have some discipline in that discussion. So each of us are taking notes about what the others say. We've each expressed our tentative views. On the basis of those tentative views, at the end of the two-week period, the chief or whoever is senior in the majority will assign the opinion. Somebody will assign a dissent. And if it's assigned to me, I start writing. Everyone has his own way of doing it. I usually ask the clerks to prepare a long memo or a draft. I like it to be quite long, everything they're thinking. I'll then go read that. I'll read the briefs again. I will sit down and write my own draft. I send it back to the clerk. The clerk's a little disappointed, but nonetheless, then, say, writes her draft. Get it back. I say, no, this isn't good. Quite often it's my fault. Well, but anyway, I say, well, I'm going to write it again. And usually it takes me two drafts from scratch. It just does. That's it. And because it's hard, because I'm a former academic, and academic in there has a very hard time, you know, just accepting somebody else's paragraph. There's nothing wrong with it if you did, but I mean, you know, you start writing the word and it unravels, and you say, well, now that I've written this word, I'll do this a lot better next week. Before you know it, the whole thing's unraveled. Well, eventually, that finishes. We go back and forth. We have the draft. We circulate it. The dissent circulates. Concurrences. Anybody can write anything he wants. I get 5 votes. That's it. It's the opinion of the court. And I breathe a sigh of relief. And sometimes I won't. Sometimes the court flips. Once or twice a year, maybe. But eventually, everybody's written. Everybody's said whatever he has to say or joined. That's it. At the first order of business is always go down the cases that are circulating at the conference. Are they ready? Everybody said what he has to say. Fine. Done. Out. That's the process. That's about 10 or 15 minutes. Because with a court, what you see is what you get. What's the story behind the story? Not much. My first draft? What do you think of your first draft? Mother's interested. Friend of yours. Boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever. I don't know. But usually it's an effort to reach the last draft. And that's true of us too. There's not some like a secret cabal going on. Pretty much what you read in the final opinion resembles very closely what was there in that first discussion. Now that's different from a legislature. After all, a legislature, statute, does it say why the statute is there? Of course not. It tells you what to do. It doesn't tell you why the legislature is telling you to do it. But a good judicial opinion is not like that. A good judicial opinion is an opinion which tells you why the judge reached that conclusion, and if it's a good opinion, those will be the real reasons. So it's not surprising that there's going to be more of a story behind the story in respect to the legislature than there is in respect to a court. And we're at court. I mean, you read the high visibility things in the newspaper, but 40% of the time we're unanimous. 5-4s are about 20%. It's certainly not always the same 5 or the same 4. We don't all have cases all the time like Guantanamo. We might decide Guantanamo. We did have 2 cases involving Guantanamo. But we also can have a case, of course, of this comma, 40327C of the Internal Revenue Code, mean that the next word, which is a 4, should be read as a which or a that. I found that interesting. My colleagues did not. there we are. It can be because you see what the criterion is. So there's a split on that. We have to take it. Or it can be a right to assisted suicide. Anyway, that's the process. I wanted you to have that as background. I sit there still and I see people of every race, religion, point of view, everybody in the world, 300 million people. As I said, it's a big country and they have very different points of view and they're all committed to deciding these questions under law. So, of course, you're part of that system. You're part of that system. Good thing. Introduction over. Yes?
Has conference changed under Roberts?
A little, not much. He's a bit more informal. He's younger. When I got to the court, Rehnquist was almost 70 years old. And so he's an older man. We get set in our ways, unfortunately. and that Robert's a little younger, and he probably is willing to have, he put up with a little more discussion. That is, he likes a little more discussion. Not a lot. You can't have a lot more. But not too much. Yes.
What do you think about TV and court?
Well, it's a hard question. It's a hard question. I think most of us think, if you think of the process going on, I think it'd be good if people could see it, because it is nine people trying to do their job, and I think that would be healthy. If people are so suspicious of law, they're so suspicious of judges and everything else, they have so little confidence. When I tell other audiences, older audiences, say exactly what I've told you, they're simply delighted. And the reason they're delighted is because it suggests that I and my colleagues are trying to do our job. And so if you could see that on television, I think that would be a very reassuring thing. And I think of a case like our term limits case, where that was a hard question. It was, can Arkansas term limit the members of Congress? Two terms and you're out. And the Constitution, you know, has some language. It isn't clear. There are arguments both sides. You had Story and Jefferson on one side and Hamilton and Madison on the other side. And they really all thought about it. They came to opposite conclusions, and the cases were exactly, you know, balanced. And it was a very, very close case. And they'd see that. And that would be good to hear those arguments. But what's on the other side? One, I think we're worried, I would be, that if it's in the Supreme Court, even though the Supreme Court is clearly not a trial court, and even though you don't have to worry about witnesses and juries, we're still a symbol. So maybe if it came into the Supreme Court, it would be in every trial in the country. And what honestly do I think of O.J. Simpson? Makes me nervous. Makes me very nervous having criminal trials and saying, well, we just put them all over the place. Another thing that worries me is that an appeals court is speaking to an audience that's not in front of it. We decide questions of law. Those bind hundreds of millions of people. They're not there in front of us. Now, when a viewer looks at a television screen, he sees people. And people react to people. So he'll see two lawyers, and maybe they'll show him the client somewhere. And that's not such a great thing. I mean, we're anonymous, we should be. Because that's why we wear black robes, I think. And the viewer won't easily relate to the millions of people who will be affected by this rule but are not parties to the case. And then I worry they'll get distorted. They'll think that the oral argument is really what's going on, and I know the oral argument is 5% of what's going on. It's really in writing. All right, so, and then there might be other things. Who knows what'll happen? Who knows? Now, you see, I see some things one way and some the other way, not surprising for a judge. But all of us have one reaction that's very conservative. We've inherited this institution. It means a lot to people. Nobody wants to be responsible for hurting it. However good the arguments, we're for making a change. So we become very conservative. And that's the state of the art at the moment. I usually say that when the television people want to, you know, make a big fuss about it, argues, I said, well, do some studies. Find out what's happened in California. Do serious social science studies. Then they write back and say, oh, we have studies. No, they don't. They have compilations of anecdotes from judges, which are not studies. Serious social science studies. Hasn't been done. So there, that's the waffle position I'm in. I'm not sure. We're trying radio, by the way. That works very well.
There was a Washington Post article about your plaza.
Oh, at the State of the Union. I think it's important to go to the State of the Union. I've gone every time. I think that is an awkward thing. That disturbs people. Sometimes we have to sit there non-political in this big political event. I sort of enjoy the spectacle. I don't look at it. It's your hardship. But I think it's important for us to be there. We're part of the government, too. And people will relate to that. They'll see us and think courts are part of the system of the government. When do we applaud? Well, you shouldn't applaud. When? Well, you applaud when he comes in, the president, applaud when he goes out. But what about in the middle when everybody's jumping up and down like a jack-in-the-box? My own thought is this, and we pretty much follow that. If you think there could be a litigant, really a litigant, in a case, and that litigant would have a picture of you jumping up. Would you think you were prejudiced? Okay? So that's why I'm hesitant to jump up when they start directly or indirectly talking about Iraq. If it's programmatic, don't stand up. Those are details. Don't. I mean, if it's programmatic, overtly political, something that somebody might think you're prejudiced, don't stand up. So that keeps us down almost the entire time. But, you know, if they introduce somebody up on the balcony, which is a woman whose husband was killed in Iraq, my goodness. I mean, I'm certainly not going to stay, you know, sitting down when something like that happens so people can get up, and I don't think anybody holds it against us. But when they start talking about why it's a good thing or a bad thing, I won't apply. Basically, yes. They're not that easy to apply, but it's, yeah.
There was a quote by Judge Posner recently in the New Yorker where he said that it's hard to look at Supreme Court decisions and say that any of them are right or wrong, and instead that they're more justified as political decisions. How would you respond to that?
I think that, well, I mean, I know he has this theory, which I don't think is right, unless he means it in a special sense. And I think he might. You'd have to ask him. Political to me means, because I worked in the Judiciary Committee for a couple of years, and anyone exposed to the process, and people who are exposed to the political process in many ways, thinks political. Are you a Republican or are you a Democrat? Are you going to do something that will help Senator Feinstein win? Or are you going to do something to help her opponent win? Are you going to, who gets the votes? Who's popular? Now that's politics. And that I haven't seen. You say, well, what about Bush v. Gore? We can say a little bit about that later, but I'll put that to the side. But that's the only even arguable one. I mean, I've been there 11 years. I don't see that kind of politics, which I think of as politics ever. I just don't see it. And I'm not close. But maybe what it means is, well, we decide, or people decide on the basis of, are you an Adam Smith free enterpriser, or are you a Maoist struggle sessioner? ideology. No, I mean, if I find myself, that's harder, but if I find myself thinking I'm doing it for some ideological reason, I know that that's no. Okay, so I'll try not to do that. I can't say 100% success. I try, and I think people are reasonably successful. If what you mean is when these big open questions, liberty, does it include assisted suicide? Lots of arguments both ways, you know. If they weren't open, if the language explained it, why are they in front of us? I mean, lots and lots of these questions are absolutely very hard to figure out in terms of the Constitution. Is this an unreasonable search and seizure? Isn't it? When you get those large open questions, are you influenced by your background, by your upbringing, by your law school experience, by your professional experience, by all those things that might, after 10 or 15 or 20 years, have given you a kind of view of how law relates to the world and to human beings? Yeah, I think we're influenced by that. I don't see how you couldn't be. You can't jump out of your own skin. But insofar as you can't escape your sort of basic views, say, about how law relates to people in the world, and people have different views of that, you know. Well, insofar as you can't escape that, and you can't, that's as it should be, in my view. Because, and that's really why it's important to have presidents appoint different members of the Supreme Court. Not because the president will, in fact, be able to, did I say this yesterday? No. See, if I talk to five audiences now at my event, this question comes up a lot. I'm not making this answer up for the first time. But if you have different presidents, the presidents appoint people. If they think they're going to appoint a judge, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt appointed Oliver Wendell Holmes. And the first year, he dissents in Northern Securities, began a trust case, meant a lot to Roosevelt. Roosevelt was furious and said, I could appoint a judge with more backbone out of a banana, carved out of a banana. But he was annoyed. Judges think, presidents think the judge is going to decide in particular cases for them. They have a big surprise coming, if that's what they think.
And if they think, though, that I want a person who shares a kind of very abstractly put general philosophy about the nature of government in the United States, they'll be closer. They won't always get it right, because they're in for surprises too, but it's closer. And that means that different presidents appointing different judges over time are likely to get a mix of judicial approaches considered in a very abstract way. 300 million people who think 500 million different things, good, good. And some of the differences are explained. So if Dick Posner means that, although that abstracts from 90% of what's going into such a case, I couldn't say that the remaining 10% is not partly that. And it is. So to that extent, I would agree. Yes?
What type of interaction do you have with the other justices outside of the conference?
Outside the conference, there's some social life. It's not sort of like old pal. We all get along well. We usually have lunch together during the sessions. As I say, in the conference, I've never heard anybody get angry or say anything insulting about anybody else. It just doesn't happen. On cases, if you want to talk to, and I'll talk to some judges, you know, I mean, sometimes we'll talk and infer about a case before, sometimes after. Usually the way the communication, I said February we're going into the argument. I've been reading the cases. I'm certainly not going to talk to anybody about any of the cases, at least for 10 days. Why? Because I don't know if they will have read the case yet and be up on it until that argument is just about to take place. Now I know the other judge has taken it in because he or she has to be ready for the argument too. So now, just a day before the argument, a couple of days before conference, very important time. Because during that time, I now know the case pretty well. I have a view about it. I always have a view. I mean, almost always. I'll have a view from the time I read that question presented. I read the question presented, I think, huh, I see the answer. Then I read the brief, I certainly see the answer. Then I read the other side, You see, I mean, you do go through this process, which is the old joke. The judge says, you know, the plaintiff, well, he's right. And then he says the defense, he's right. And then somebody says, we can't both be right. And you say, that's right. And that is what goes on. You know, your tentative view, the view shifts. You're now have a different tentative view. You're holding yourself out open to being persuaded. And that's very much happening during that week. Thinking about the case, you're open to being persuaded. I go into the oral argument. I might talk to somebody before. But a lot of communication takes place during the oral argument. Part of what happens is people are listening to each other because they know that the others and themselves are asking questions that are important to them. So if the question's important to you, I then get a point, I get an idea of what you're thinking, where you're coming from. So that's a form of communication, and I might communicate before the conference with somebody. I might talk to somebody. I might phone them. I might just go in and talk to them. Then at the conference, there's still more, but all this time, as you get closer and closer and closer to the end of the conference, people are still tentative. They say, I'm still tentative. I'm holding myself out open, but there it's becoming less and less open. And by the time the conference is finished, it's very hard to change a person's mind after that. It can happen, but very hard. And then communication will take place through memo, through alternative drafts. And sometimes by phoning somebody or going in to see them. But that's found in a court of appeals too. Yes?
I don't know how much you can speak to a specific case, but I'm curious why the court decided to grant cert in the recent assisted suicide case. That seems to violate the criterion of settling on the law.
Oh, you mean in the. Yeah, I mean, that's why I qualify. I qualify what I say. I say usually you try to see that there's a split. Sometimes you won't. One time in which you probably won't just see if there's a split is if there's a federal law and the lower court has held that that's unconstitutional or they've decided against the government. I mean, that's a federal law passed by Congress.
we better review it. Now, that's not 100% either, but you see a case you think is important. You think that it was a rule that seemed important, and in the original assisted suicide case, we took that without a split. But there you see you had two circuits, the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit, both of which had held that a law of the state that forbid the assisted suicide was unconstitutional. So you think, well, across the country, they're not being able to enforce their criminal law in any politically, i.e., there's where politics in the sense that an awful lot of people are concerned about it. Well, maybe we better straighten this out. Maybe that shows a need. Well, that's sort of what's going on.
Yes. To what degree are justices willing to negotiate or change language in close cases in order to get a majority?
Yes, a lot. We'll try to get a majority. Each of us knows that really we've got to have a majority. The court is the court. It's not us personally. And each of us also knows the academics, including me when I was an academic, used to say, what's wrong with this court? It's just 9 individualists. They're on an ego trip. And they want the Constitution according to this person or that person. What we want is a unified court decision. I used to make that complaint a lot. And said, you need 5 people. You need a decision at the court. So the second year I'm on the court, we decide Turner Broadcasting. Turner Broadcasting involved whether it is constitutional for can Congress pass a law that says cable companies have to carry over-the-air broadcasting. 4 people join an opinion that says, yes, Congress can do that because it's trying to cure antitrust problems of a certain kind. 4 people say, no, because that antitrust stuff is a bunch of rubbish. I think they're wrong. It is rubbish, but Congress can do it anyway. All right. Now, remember, I'm a former antitrust professor. It's awfully hard for me to join an opinion that's writing all this antitrust stuff that I think is basically wrong. But I think that side is right. So I just couldn't do it. So I wrote a separate opinion. There we are. 4-4-1. Exactly what I've been complaining about. So now you have the illustration of what the problem is. The problem is we try. People try very hard to get a uniform decision. Usually memos go around and ask for whole bunches of changes, and people will try to make the changes. But depending on the individual, there can be certain things you say, I just can't agree to that. I just can't. I feel that it's important enough, and I feel that it's wrong, and I just can't do it. And then you get a separate opinion. Yes?
How would term limits for justices change the operation of the court?
Well, it would depend term limits on what they are. I mean, I think you got to say 20 years, 25 years, wouldn't matter much. But, if you had a short term, it wouldn't matter. I wouldn't do that. The whole object of having a... I wouldn't do that because, for one thing, it takes 3 or 4 years to get used to it. But for another, you don't want people there calculating what their next job is going to be. That's a virtue of the federal judiciary. You don't want them calculating their next job, and they will if they leave. And it's better to give them the independence, and that means the security, and that requires a long term. A long term of years wouldn't bother me. Anyway, it would apply. you might have to amend the Constitution. Depends on how you did it, I guess. So I don't know if it's a real issue. Yes?
How much of a role do amicus briefs play in the decision-making process?
It depends. I think sometimes they play an important role. I like to have amicus briefs that give me a perspective that I don't otherwise have. For example, we had a case involving ERISA, which was very technical, and it involved the application of ERISA to a kind of something from New Orleans called a widow's pension, and we got an amicus brief from a property bar that really explained this property law of Louisiana, which I had very helpful, in the right to die case, we had amicus briefs, we had about 70, 60 or so, and from all kinds of groups, the hospice workers, and they were split often, hospice workers for, hospice workers against, doctors, psychologists, retarded people, groups, all kinds of different groups. I found those helpful because they were trying to explain what the effect of a decision one way or another would be in the world that they knew. Affirmative action, very important. I thought those amicus briefs there were very important because the question was whether the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause permits some degree of affirmative action. Well, we had briefs from army generals, military, businesses, labor unions, major universities, educational groups, a lot. All of them were good on both sides, but I mean, these really made a difference, I think, because they said, look, and we'll explain why. We're not saying we need a lot of affirmative action, but please let us interpret the Constitution so that we can have some. Because if we can't have any distinction, even among, you know, similarly qualified people where all kinds of intangible things are at stake, if we can't do this, you are going to see that it will be impossible to have an army where the officer corps reflects either the nation's racial makeup or at least that of the non-officer corps. And that's going to be terrible. We're not going to be able to run our army. And the business community told us quite similar things about operating in today's world. Ultimately, I think it provided empirical grounding, or at least more than anecdotal. I mean, it was really, there were a lot of people on this. And then the court begins to think, well, you know, my goodness, this is a country where everyone is supposed to participate. It's a country where you don't want groups of people thinking, I don't belong to this country. How can they participate, or will they participate in the political process, in the democratic process, if they think they're excluded because of race, say, from a lot of major institutions? And could the 14th Amendment really foresee that kind of result? And I think that has a role. And I think the amicus groups were very helpful in that respect. I was of the majority on that, which said some degree of affirmative action is permissible. So naturally, I perhaps pushed in that direction, but I thought they were helpful. In many cases, I think very helpful. They're not very helpful either when they, just for PR arguments, or when they say, well, our group, you know, is for this. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, well, I think in terms of would I prefer other things being equal, you know, I didn't do any of the appointing. And moreover, I know nothing about the appointments process. I often say it's like asking the recipe of chicken a la king from the point of view of the chicken. I was the appointed person, I'm not the appointing person. As an appointed person, I like having a few women on the court. I like the diversity. I think it improves the court. And you say, well, how exactly and why? I can't tell you exactly how and why. I couldn't break it down. I think at least it has a role, we use the word trite, but this role model idea has something to it, in my opinion. And diversity among the clerks, I think since I've been there, the 11 years, I think we have quite a lot, and a lot more than we did. And it's interesting. I like it. You know, I like it from a cold, calculating perspective, getting the work done. And it's fine, and I think that might have been initially a kind of issue when 11 years ago. I don't think it's much of an issue. Yeah.
What, if any, role do you think Justice O'Connor will play going forward?
Oh, I hope she'll be active in all kinds of things. She's very, very good. One of the things I've, you know, I feel I've learned a lot from her, and
And among other things, we carry a kind of label called Supreme Court of the United States. And sometimes that interferes with personal relationships, but very often it can be used in a helpful way. And she's expert. She really knows how to do that. She is a constructive person. She continuously doesn't want an hour to pass without trying to accomplish something good. And she knows how to, in a speech or a talk or meeting people, she knows how to maximize that value. I mean, she might give us, you have to be careful. Don't get involved in politics. Don't say things that are get you in the newspaper in a controversial way. Maybe you have to retreat to, like, cliches. But so then retreat. Because the object there is try to encourage other people to do things that will be of value to them, the group, the nation, whoever. And she's so good at that. I mean, we went on a tour, for example, of the Indian reservations out here about 5 years ago. It was great. And we learned quite a lot. We two of us, we've done a lot of certain amount of travel. We went to India, where we'd meet the judges, and it isn't just a public relations thing. It's also because they have big problems with backlog. So we can go there, and because we have the label, they're trying to introduce ADR, alternative dispute resolution, mediation, arbitration, etc. And there are all kinds, as there are in many places, a lot of bureaucratic obstacles to an admittedly good thing that would be helpful to them. So we go, and she says, or I can say, you know, hey, what are you doing? Oh, we haven't done that. You want to have a meeting and talk about it? And they'll go and run to the people because they want to do it. Say, hey, well, there are two judges here, a few of them from the United States. And, let's have our meeting and see what we can get done. And something sometimes gets done, not always. But I'm saying she's very good at knowing how to do that. And it's very hard to do. And so I hope she stays very active in that, and I suspect she will. Yes? You go ahead in the back of the video. Go ahead.
I just had a question about writing. You spoke a lot about reading a lot. I was wondering if you speak about certain traits you find that make good writing, certain traits that make up bad writing, and who's kind of influence your own writing style?
Well, my own writing, I mean, I have the word processor, like most people do, in the back of my, swivel my chair around, and I write. And writing, the only lesson I've learned in how to write is write. You just have to keep doing it. That's why clerking is a good experience, because you have to write and write and write and write. And I don't know any other way to do it. Some people are natural born. I think Nino is a very good writer, Nino Scalia. And some are right, but maybe he's more like P.G. Woodhouse. I saw P.G. Woodhouse's manuscripts once. There's not a change. Not a change. He sat down and wrote those books, and they're beautifully written. Well, not all of us can do that. I can't do it. And so what I'll try to do is, because the law is pretty complicated, and I will try to pretend I'm explaining it to a reasonably intelligent person who's not necessarily expert in the area. You know, go through sort of connect the dots, but don't be too technical. Try to explain it to somebody who doesn't have that much time. Try to keep it short, and I don't use footnotes. And that prevents me, as well, from using too many citations, because it clogs up the text. So from my point of view, in a legal opinion, a citation should be there to advance the argument. It's not a law review. You're not there to identify your source as to what's original or not. Who cares? You're there to use the citation as part of the argument. So, short, in English, avoid technical words, and try to explain it from beginning to end. Who do I think was great at that? I think Nino Scalia is pretty good at that. I think Justice Jackson's probably one of the greatest writers on the court. Holmes is pretty good, but he's awfully succinct. He once said to Justice White, supposedly old Justice White, Chief Justice, he said, we're the two best lawyers on the court because I write so long, you write opinions that are so long no one can understand them, and I write them so short no one can understand them, so we won't get into trouble. But that's about as well as I can do. The only advice I can offer people is the same I just said, write, and then try to explain it to your roommate or friend, and give it to somebody, say, I only have 3 minutes to read it. Perfect.
Yeah,
understand it in 3 minutes, maybe you've done a good job. If not, go back and rewrite. Computer helps there, doesn't it? I mean, it's a big improvement over it really is, because you can move paragraphs around, you know, you put words in, you cross them out, get them spelled properly, possibly. But anyway. Yes. Oh, wait, you had a question.
Did you intend for your book to respond to Justice Scalia's book? And did you ever think that the public or academic response or dialogue might influence your methodology?
Conceivably. What I was trying, it's not totally yes or totally no. What I was trying to do with the book is I had to give some lectures at Harvard, you know, and so that, well, I have to say something. That's always a beginning place. What shall I say? And I'd been on the court about 8 or 9 years when I started this. And I thought, well, what I'm really curious about is, having been here for about 8 or 9 years, can I go back and look at what I've done? And is there a consistent theme? And that's the origin, and that's what I was basically trying to do. And the book is really aimed at about 2 or 3 things. One, I would say, in part, and this doesn't appear to be so, but in part it's aimed at academic people who are interested in the court. Because it's not a theory. It's a report. It's a report put into words that make it more organized than it really is. But it's some cases and other things, and I say, I'll tell you, I did decide the case this way. And as I go back and look at it, it seems to me that the cases are very much affected in certain ways by, not determinative ways, but certain ways by this great theme of the Constitution, the democratic theme, which is one of several. I'm reporting that to you. And you can take it for whatever you want. You can criticize it. You can say, it's great. You can do whatever you want with it. But you can't say that isn't what I did, because that is what I did. So in that sense, it's meant to be an explanation, a kind of rationalized view of what I think at least one judge, and probably several, how they might approach problems on the court. Then another, and which is certainly a big objective, is, and probably this, again, I say things come from my background. I grew up in San Francisco, pretty open, pretty democratic place, pretty tolerant place. So this democratic theme probably has influenced me. So when I read the Constitution and see, I think this is the objective, the democratic part, and a certain kind of democracy, protecting human rights, degree of equality, rule of law, separate powers, state, federal, 3 branches, and no one becomes too powerful. I look at it that way and say, well, this is a kind of democracy. Democracy is at the heart of it. I believe that. And so I want to tell people that. And I want to tell them that because this is the proselytizing part. I want to say to you and everybody else, look, I can't tell you what to do with your life. But I can tell you that I do read this document. It's an important document to people in the United States. And it foresees that some of your time will be spent participating in some way or other in community life. Could be a school board, art museum, run for office, go to Washington if you like. I don't mind. But it does foresee that you will participate, at least vote. And I'm telling you not what to do, but if you don't do that, I don't think the document will work very well. Now that, of course, is just a way of telling you what to do. So that's a big objective. And now as part of that, too, I, of course, have to deal with the view of law that, to my way of thinking, is too wooden. Will not connect law with people. Will not connect law with life. Risks interpretations that are just removed from what either Congress did want, which is very important in a democratic society, and sometimes what anyone would have wanted. So I can't write this book without explaining why I don't hold that point of view. And in that sense, it is a reply to those who might call themselves originalists, depending on what variation they hold and so on. All right. Yes?
What are the qualities of oral argument, I guess, that are good, that, you know, be able to persuade you as a justice?
court of appeals, where you're in a court of appeals, I like to have in front of me, I used to like to have the lawyers who worked on the case. Because the lawyer who works on the case knows the case and knows what was really important in the trial and not. But what I'm really looking for is a court of appeals judge is, in a sense, I'm trying to get rid of the case. I have a lot of cases. And there might be 14 issues in a case. And most of them, many of them, are error correction cases. So if the lawyer who's appealing can point to one error, and I say, oh yeah, that is an error, good, we send it back, I don't have to deal with the rest of it. So I'm trying to see, basically, what is this case like? I want those lawyers in front of me. Is it a duck or, you know, what do they have, a Wittgenstein, whatever, the duck, goose or something, the rabbit duck, you know, did you draw this thing, is it a rabbit or is it a duck? You look at it and say, could be either optical illusion. All right, I want to know, is this a rabbit or a duck? And you, the lawyer, are going to tell me. Now, that's not the Supreme Court of the United States. Contrary to popular belief, this word that we're deciding cases and controversies is, in a certain respect, don't overstate what I say here, but in a certain respect, rubbish. Why? Because we're deciding an issue. We took it to decide an issue. That lawyer has no power to characterize the case. I want to know what this issue is and how it should be answered.